Hey there. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Famously, the Oscars are this weekend.
And the Oscar goes to...
And famously, the Oscars are really, really bad at awarding women directors. In nearly 100 years, the Academy has only given the award for Best Director to three women.
Jane Campion.
Chloe Zhao.
Catherine Bigelow.
How would you characterize the landscape for women directors in Hollywood now? Oh, you made a face.
Wow, you're really starting with the biggest existential question. I thought maybe, you know, we would sort of lead up to that.
That's Maya Montañez-Smuckler. She's a film historian and archivist who traced the rise, fall, and re-emergence of women directors in her book, Liberating Hollywood.
The state of women directors in Hollywood today, well, and I don't mean to say this to be wishy-washy, but it's complicated. As Nancy Myers, a director, would say in her movie, it's complicated.
It's complicated because women directors are finally starting to get their due in the upper echelons of Hollywood. In the past decade, we've seen Catherine Bigelow, Chloe Zhao, and Jane Campion all win Best Director. And yet, at this year's Oscars, women were completely shut out of the nominations, despite women having directed 18% of the top-grossing films in 2022. I think it's pretty clear that the state of career director women in Hollywood is better than it was, say, 50 years ago.
But it's still awful.
It's still kind of awful.
It's better and it's terrible.
Today, Maya and I are headed back to the golden era of women directors, asking why they disappeared and what barriers women directors face today, after a quick break. Maya, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here with you.
There's a moment that you open your book with when Catherine Bigelow received the Oscar for Best Director for The Hurt Locker.
From among the five gifted nominees tonight, the winner could be, for the first time, a woman.
Barbara Streisand handed her the award.
Well, the time has come. Catherine Bigelow!
And Babs herself is under-recognized as an incredible director in her own right. And you say in the book, it's a little hard to hear, but Barbara Streisand kind of jokes with Catherine Bigelow asking, can I hold it? About the award.
Yeah, it was a really precious moment and a really painful moment. Sometimes I feel like that's how all these moments of, quote, progress really resonate emotionally with all of us who are paying attention to them for our whole lives.
This really is, there's no other way to describe it. It's the moment of a lifetime.
The other thing that sticks out to me about this moment is that Oscar win happened in March 2010. And that was, you know, the first time a woman won Best Director, 2010. But Hollywood didn't always work this way. There used to be more women directors. Can you take us back to a time when women were actually much more represented in the film industry than maybe we think of them today?
In early American cinema during the silent era, there were many more women filmmakers, and there are lots of different kinds of women filmmakers. And so there's comedian Mabel Normand, there's Nell Shipman, who's making sort of action adventure films out in a more sort of wilderness landscape. She's doing her own stunts. And then the filmmaker Lois Weber, she has her own production company. She's in that top tier of film directors. She's really interested in sort of domestic marriage, heterosexual relationships, white middle class, and really interested in bringing up these sort of moral dilemmas for her characters. So, for example, she makes this film called Where Are My Children in 1916. A feature film about a white middle class family, kind of upper middle class family. And the woman and all her friends are trying to legalize birth control. she's making these films that not only present big moral questions, but she doesn't completely resolve them. And so she's really leaving some questions for her audience to reflect.
Okay, so during the silent era, you write that there are at least 57 women working as directors. Among them is Lois Weber, but then we hit the talkies. And between 1930 and the mid-1960s, there are only two recognized women directors. That is a huge drop.
Yes, it is. It's tough.
You know, it wasn't like a natural process, though, that led to fewer female directors. There were systemic changes that resulted in the pipeline kind of getting squeezed. Can you lay that out?
So the transition to sound, that transition was an enormous economic risk. And so it demanded tremendous financial investment. And so Wall Street is brought in to assist and invest in Hollywood's shift. And so with Wall Street comes the masculinized culture of the financial industry. Production is centralized. The production of films, talent is under contract. We have the big studios that are controlling production, distribution, exhibitions. We have vertical integration. And so with that comes just a more traditional social culture within this creative industry. And so women are not going to have that creative and financial control that they had during the silent era.
You know, in talking to our editor, kind of reminded her of what happened with celebrity chefs, or even just that sort of being like a chef de cuisine and cooking, where once an industry becomes quote unquote professionalized, it creates more gatekeepers and thus that shuts, you know, marginalized people, people of color, women out. But there were two women. Who were they?
We have these two singular directors, Dorothy Arzner, who transitions from the silent era to then become a director during the 30s and 40s.
I know you want me to tear my clothes off so as you can look your 50 cents worth. 50 cents for the privilege of staring at a girl the way your wives won't let you. What do you suppose we think of you up here with your silly smirks your mothers would be ashamed of?
And then Ida Lupino, who was a well-known actress who then starts her own independent production company in the late 40s.
You see, they tell me I have to decide whether you and I stick together, whether we both go our own ways.
Tell me, couldn't we try it?
You got an Ida Lupino poster behind you.
It's like 10 feet tall. It's crazy. It's my inspiration. And she writes and produces, and sometimes she even directs herself. So those are the two singular women directors during the classic Hollywood era.
You know, that takes us to the 70s, though, which is described in your book as a time that people thought of as a period of extraordinary potential for people who wanted to direct films. There was a boom in independent filmmaking and in the distribution of foreign films in the United States, which kind of shook up the filmmaking marketplace. Studios were trying to keep up and pump out movies while also trying to capture these young audiences, these young, probably now that I think about it, boomer audiences.
Yes. The big boomer audience.
Exactly. Yeah. The big boomer audience who's grown to have different like ideals and tastes than their greatest generation and silent generation parents. And so they needed young directors. Hollywood is looking for young directors. What did Hollywood do to fill that need?
As the industry then moves into the 60s and 70s, civil rights movement, feminist movement are changing every aspect of American life, social, cultural, pop culture, legal. And Hollywood is also really trying to adjust to the times. The studio system has declined. And so who's going to make these movies that's going to catch Hollywood up with audiences. So in a lot of ways, it's very true that if you were young and ambitious and love film, you could make a movie in Hollywood, make a movie for a studio in Hollywood. But the important part of that is if you were a white man. And so there's a lot, you know, all these important and favorite films, Martin Scorsese, Peter Bogdanovich, Francis Ford Coppola, Hal Ashby is a little older than this sort of figurative generation, but he's in there. Warren Beatty. There's like this sort of paradox that there is all of this change, all of this social change, all of this political change taking place, counterculture, youth culture, drug culture, Vietnam War, anti-war movement taking place. And Hollywood, of course, wants to capitalize. And a lot of executives are also part of this generation, this new Hollywood generation that's revitalizing the industry. And so you would think, oh, so this means then we're going to see more women filmmakers, all kinds of women filmmakers. We're going to see more filmmakers of color, and we don't.
Somebody that I knew of this person to be a director later in life, but I didn't know as much of the detail around Maya Angelou's desire to direct and her efforts toward that. And you get into that in your book. Like, talk to me about that. I mean, you know, this is
epic.
You're talking about Barbara Streisand earlier, right? This is Maya Angelou.
Barbara Streisand and Maya Angelou should have made a movie together in the 70s. Exactly. Would have been incredible.
Talk to me. How is someone like Maya Angelou kept from becoming a director that she wanted to be?
Oh, my goodness. In the 70s, it's announced that she is going to adapt for the screen and direct I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings as a film made by an independent production company, and that she's going to be the first Black American woman to do this. She joins the Directors Guild as the first Black woman in the feature film or in the director category. So this is an incredible historical moment. She is so busy in the 70s. She writes the screenplay, original screenplay for the film Georgia, Georgia, starring Diana Sands in 1972. She really wanted to direct that film, but they picked a Swedish man to do it instead. She ends up not being able to direct I Know Why a Caged Bird Sings, and it ends up being made as a TV movie in 1979. And she talks a lot in the press about how she was really frustrated with that. She really wanted to direct that film. So she is just constantly on the brink of something. And she just never can make that feature film in the director's capacity. Of course, in 1997, she makes her directorial debut with Down
In the Delta.
In the Delta.
For Showtime,
and she's in her 70s.
Yeah, it's you've really broken down the fact that Barbara Streisand and Maya Angelou were kind of kept from realizing their, you know, directing aspirations during that period, or at least in the way that they wanted to. Two of the biggest, most impactful women on, you know, American cultural history ever, right? If they couldn't do it, then it kind of poked some holes in that ethos that anyone can make a movie.
Right.
In the last 13 years, since Catherine Bigelow's Oscar win, we have seen a couple of other women win for Best Director. But when you sort of pull back, you could see that in the grand scheme of things, not very many women have even been nominated for that award. I think it's fewer than 10 have been nominated for that award in the history of the Oscars. And so it's good to see some progress. But, you know, as we mentioned at the top of this conversation, that this year is a shutout for women directors, even though there were films that people have been talking about, like The Woman King, like She Said, or Women Talking, or After Sun. There's evidence of change, right, in the last 13 years since Catherine Bigelow won the Oscar. But still, it kind of feels like, to your point, we're jogging in place a little bit. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is. I mean, sometimes I think, like, then let's just, you know, not worry about the Oscars. But of course, we have to, because we're not going to give the Oscars a pass, because they represent the highest accolades. And to give them a pass is to give, the legacy of sexism and racism in Hollywood have passed. So we can't do that. And we just have to always be talking about all of the films made by women and all kinds of films and all kinds of women filmmakers. And we just have to do that in the same breath. It's what our job is, to always be balancing that conflict of no progress with evidence of
something
great and fabulous work. And even the flops too, and of course to be able to have a failure and bounce back, which is,
that's the key.
That's the key.
Yeah.
That's the real. Because
I'm not going to name names, but there are a lot of men who have made a career off of being like, I don't know how this movie's going to turn out, but it is your 12th feature film. So.
Right. Second, third, 10th choices. I mean, sometimes, yeah, that's really, I think, and you hear women directors say that all the time, like, you know, I had one small film. It was low performing. And then that was it. It took me 10 years to get another chance. I mean, that's awful. To be able to build a robust filmography that has some flops and successes, because filmmakers have to grow. They have to practice their act. I mean, I can't imagine that everybody gets it right every time. I mean, some people do, but...
Maya, thank you so much. This was a dream of a conversation for me. It was so great to get your mind on this topic.
Thank you, Brittany. It was great to be here with you.
That was Maya Montañez-Smuckler. Her book is called Liberating Hollywood: Women Directors and the Feminist Reform of 1970s American Cinema. Coming up, I'm digging into our cultural obsession with the ultra-rich on screen, and what all those rich people TV dramas do to our psyches. Lately, I've been watching a lot of movies and TV shows that immerse us in the lives of filthy, rich jerks. Triangle of Sadness, The Menu, The White Lotus, Succession. And I don't watch Billions, but I did just learn that it's about to have 4 spin-off shows.
You can't swing a diamond-studded something or another without hitting a prestige project about the ultra-wealthy. There's a lot of these shows.
That's Nina Metz. She's a TV and film critic at the Chicago Tribune. And she thinks there's too many stories about the super elite, especially when there's been increased public interest in organized labor. Last year, union petitions were up by half, and over 200,000 Americans became unionized workers.
Did you know that last year was such a big year for union organizing?
I was not aware that many new unions had formed in the U.S. I had no idea.
And those storylines are absent from what we're seeing in TV and film.
I chat with Nina about what happened to all the union movies and what prestige dramas about the rich actually do to our psyches. Nina, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thanks for having me.
To jump right in, these pieces of media or entertainment, these films and TV shows, are obviously being ushered in by executives. But also, I mean, they are being released to a public that is enjoying them at the very least. I mean, even if some of these shows, I don't love the characters, I don't feel like following every plot line, I'll show up every week because some of them are just well done. What is it about these shows or movies about the super wealthy that appeal to us as viewers?
I think there's a few different reasons. I think audiences are seeking out escapism, and escapism is not without value, especially when it feels like the screws are tightening. I sometimes think of it as thumbing through a copy of Architectural Digest. It's fun to kind of like dive into those spaces. Like you said, they're very well made. The acting is terrific. And these different shows are doing different things. I think Succession's appeal is that, you know, it's this group of very punchy people who are dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. The writing is very antic and sharp. Mm-hmm. And it really invites you to laugh at them.
Greg, this is not Charles Dickens' world, okay? You don't go around talking about principles.
Which is can feel sort of cathartic, right? Yeah. Like, you have all this money and you're still so miserable.
Exactly. Exactly. And on some level, you're like, I might have student loan debt that I'll be paying off for the next 40 years of my life, but I know a mother's love. Or like, right. you know,
right.
or like me and my siblings haven't plotted on each other, like
exactly.
in very serious and real ways. It's like almost like cold comfort. But many of these shows, like Succession and The White Lotus, or even extending outward to films like The Menu and Triangle of Sadness, these shows and films can be critical of the super rich. In your opinion, do they go far enough?
I would say that these stories are primarily critical of individuals who are on screen. They're not critical of systems that exist and systems that are sort of deliberately designed to benefit the few at the cost of the many, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very deft way of not actually having to engage with the issues. Like, let's talk about The Menu. The Menu is a movie where if you are a legitimately rich person watching that, which, by the way, a lot of people in Hollywood would fall into that category.
Sure, sure.
If you're watching that, it's very easy for you to say, well, I would never be an obnoxious person like that guy that John Leguizamo is playing.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I would never
be
like those finance bros.
You know who we are, right?
Yes.
Flip us a little bread.
No.
Ah, did you say no?
I said no, yes.
Okay.
Wow. I am cool. I'm polite to service workers, right? It gives you an out. It becomes like about personal behavior rather than the structures that create all this inequity and perpetuate it and sort of lock it into place. I mean, I think we're seeing Eat the Rich stories, but those aren't going to galvanize anyone to do anything, right? Which is probably the point.
With the lack of union TV shows and movies and a lot of TV shows and movies about billionaires, what messaging do you think Hollywood is sending to America?
There's something sort of defeatist about it, I think. The best you can hope for is to laugh at these fools with their money. And I think a lot of people would disagree with me because they get sucked into the stories. But I think ultimately these shows are very, there's something empty about them. The world doesn't need maybe another story about the inner lives of the wealthy. Like we have been immersed in the inner lives of the wealthy. And at the same time, there's a conspicuous dearth of other kinds of stories. I think Hollywood executives should feel that question aimed towards them. Why aren't you giving us these stories? Why?
We've been talking about stories about power, at least just within the context of this conversation, kind of between two poles. There is like collective action and the uber wealthy to, you know, to whom we are nothing but peons, right? But there is a third narrative trope that Hollywood loves to rely on, and that is that of the superhero. And I think that presents like another way of thinking about power, where you have the big bads, you got superhero or a cadre of superheroes who are there to defend the defenseless, who
right.
are thought to be, you know, people like you and I. And
right.
these superheroes have extraordinary abilities that allow them to stand up to these big bad guys.
They're special, right?
There's generally only one or fewer than 100 of them standing up to, you know, the forces of evil in this world. Are studio executives, could they be so attached to the superhero trope that they can't imagine making a popular movie about collective action?
Right. You know, the guy who's the creator of The Boys, which is a TV series on Amazon, which is sort of a satire, let's say, of a lot of superhero tropes, has sort of argued that so many years of superhero movies maybe have conditioned people to feel like someone has to come save us. Like we don't save ourselves. It's someone else's job, someone with more resources, more talent, more whatever. I think there's actually something to that because there's another genre, especially on TV, which are cop shows.
Right.
And so to me, I think, if you look at these stories in aggregate, what they are saying is, if there's any saving to be done, leave that to us. Because you regular people, you can't beat the odds. If we take all of this together, maybe that's one message that's being sold to us. Well, on the flip side, you sort of have the narcotic of Succession, The White Lotus. None of these things are inspiring people to action. So again, is that intentional or is that just a byproduct of what's been happening in Hollywood right now? I don't know. But I do think the media we consume isn't just entertainment. It seeps into our subconscious and it shapes the way we think about the world and the way we think about what's possible. So if seeing regular people band together, if that was ubiquitous in TV and film, it would probably seem less daunting.
The lack of representation around unions is even more surprising to me. When you think about the Hollywood writer's strike of 2007-2008, which lasted months. It lasted so long that it changed the media landscape. It paved the way for the rise of reality television because there weren't writers. So producers and execs had to come up with unscripted programming. Many of the people who are working in TV today remember this writer's strike of 2007-2008. But also, like, Hollywood is preparing for the possibility of another Writers Guild strike this spring. There's probably a lot of union scripts out there somewhere, right? Somebody's writing these union stories.
Yeah.
But where are, I guess, the union shows and union movies of today? Like, somebody's probably writing these things. Why aren't they getting to the screen where you and I might see them?
I've heard from a few people very off the record that, you know, they will have meetings with development executives who would be interested in storylines like this. But further up the food chain, it's just not going to get greenlit. The very Hollywood executives we're referring to would be the targets in this story of bosses who need to reform and stop exploiting their workers. So we're not in the rooms where the decisions are being made.
Right.
And where executives are sort of speaking freely. So all we can do is try to extrapolate from what is getting made.
Are there narrative challenges to making union movies?
I mean, I think there are challenges to making a good story. And I suspect that there are many screenwriters who can and do want to do this. They're just not getting the funding. They're just not getting greenlit. I was looking back, you know, there's all these old shows on Tubi. The A-Team is one of them. Uh-huh. The A-Team was this action-adventure show from the 80s. It's a goofy show, and it's about these sort of soldiers of fortune who help out the little guy. I did not expect to see an episode devoted to helping farm workers unionize.
The A-Team thanks you. The newly founded Workers' Cooperative thanks you.
You'll have a union in this valley over my dead body!
That's exactly what I was telling our union members this morning.
We're working on a field.
This is in 1983, this episode airs.
I mean, that's squarely in Reagan's America.
That's right. And we don't even just see a random episode like that today on broadcast network TV. It's just not showing up as a storyline, let alone the main storyline. You know, the most recent show that really sort of dug into this was Superstore.
Yeah, I loved that show.
Yeah, which, you know, has not been on the air for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
It was the last one. It was a show about work. I really like shows about work and the work of work. And Superstore was about work. And it was told from the perspective of these big box workers unionizing and what that process looked like.
Sandra is going to be passing out some union authorization cards.
Can I keep mine on my wallet?
Oh, sorry. I should clarify. After you sign, I file them with the National Labor Relations Board.
I'm going to laminate mine.
No. Again, I do need those back.
If we're talking about, like, on the shows that currently exist on a show-by-show basis, why aren't we seeing storylines either like that one-off A-Team episode or more sort of concerted storylines I think there's the fear that when you talk about like labor issues, it sounds like eat your vegetables content. Does not sound fun, right? Oh, gosh.
I could see that.
Like the white, let's go on a 5-star vacation right. to the White Lotus. Right. I don't want right. to do labor organizing. But here are two shows that are very popular that are not necessarily about unions, but they're about work mm-hmm. and labor. Abbott Elementary.
Yes.
And The Bear.
Yeah.
So these are two very different shows about people, some of who don't even like each other, coming together to problem solve, to strategize, to figure out a way to do the thing together. It's not an individualistic project. It only works if we all come together to figure this out. And those shows are funny and very, very popular. So they're sort of these outliers that I think provide a good counterbalance. It's not enough, but I feel like they are a persuasive argument that there's an audience for this. People like these shows and they will watch them.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Nina Metz. You can find her work at the Chicago Tribune. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
Our editor is
Jessica Plachek.
Our intern is
Jamal Michelle.
Engineering support came from
Joby Tanseco.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
Our senior VP of programming is
Anya Grundman.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.